You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Mary Margaret Slack toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, welcome to The Wire for Tuesday, the 23rd of July. I'm your host, Mary Margaret. I'm joined in studio by two of my buddies, Sam
Hello.
Smith and Connor Now. How are you?
Good.
Very well.
Pretty good. What a second week uni. How are we going?
Pretty good.
Look, I'm still at the point with no assignments and I'm loving it.
It's nice. I'm the same. It's pretty easy going.
On cloud now.
I haven't had any assignments for 2 years.
Well, we're all jealous. I feel like the day when you have no more exams is like the best day of your life.
Yes, it
is. I'm sure.
But for now, coming up on the show, Sam speaks to two uni students who have started Mana for Men, a collective for young men facing depression, anxiety, all the kinds of mental issues that you can face, and the group trains to run a marathon. In Connor's international segment this week, he's looking into the Zimbabwe election.
Yes, indeed. We're going to go through the background of it a little bit, of the country, and what we can expect when Emmerson Mnangagwa inevitably gets into power.
It's definitely your niche.
You're quickly becoming our African correspondent.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do a lot on Africa.
It's good.
Africa's a lot, very exciting. It's happening,
it's a great place.
Also, like, so vast and misunderstood when we're this far away. So it's good that we have Connor to guide us.
Massive landmass.
Exactly.
After that, it's Wire Worry Week, and we're focusing on substance use, abuse, and legislation. Pearl Little speaks to Adam Winstock about music festival pill testing. And finally, Oscar is doing the Green Desk this week, and he speaks to Dr. Alvera Demise about the cycle of food production in Aotearoa. He aha o whakaro, get in touch with us with any thoughts that you have. Tukupatuhi mai, you can text us on 5395, or why am I? Give us a call on 309 3879.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Now, it's no secret New Zealand has one of the highest suicide rates in the OECD, and 1 in 7 people will experience a major depressive episode in their life at some point. In these statistics, men in particular are overrepresented, and for years the subject of mental health and opening up about it has been somewhat of a taboo subject for males. Well, a group of university students have decided to change this. They've started a group called Mana for Men, and they're aiming to raise awareness around men's mental health and encourage blokes to open up about their feelings. So earlier I spoke to one of the founders, Louis Laws. I guess firstly, how did the campaign for Mana for Men come about?
Yeah, great question, Sam. So, well, pretty much how Mana for Men started, I guess, is that, you know, around the start of the year, me and a few of my mates, we really wanted to look at our fitness, and we started running, you know, just running together as groups, and kind of, you know, as our fitness kind of improved, we're thinking, well, look, you know, like, this is going great, let's, you know, do it for a cause, let's do it for, you know, a goal at the end. And we said, why not do the Auckland Marathon? And we thought, well, if we're going to do this, let's kind of get a bit of a cause behind it. And I think we came to the conclusion that men's mental health to us is really an important issue, and one which I don't think hasn't really been, you know, spoken up for a lot. So we were like, look, if we run this marathon and we, along the way, raise a bit of money for it, this could be something really great. So basically the idea was born from there, and it's just gone up and up and up.
And what's like the overall goal you've got in mind?
Well, I guess the goal started off with just raising some awareness, you know. Really, it's an issue that we want to speak up for, because we just feel that the voice isn't really there yet. I mean, you can see it really improving and coming through. But I mean, with that goal in mind of raising awareness, we also really want to be actively, you know, getting out there and raising some money for the Men's Mental Health Foundation, because it's a super important cause and we're trying to back it, you know, all the way.
Because it's no secret New Zealand has like a very high suicide rate.
Absolutely.
1 in 7 people you see on your website will experience a depressive episode in their lifetime. So
yeah,
for men, these sorts of issues seem to be quite taboo and not talked about in the open. Why do you think this is?
I think it really comes from that kind of Kiwi culture, and also just culture within young males, which really, you know, reflecting back on it, you know, it's happened in my life, it's happened in my father's life, and it's something that really needs to change. It's almost like the masculine kind of landscape, especially, is really prevalent in New Zealand males, and it's something that I think with this kind of, you know, things such as Mana for Men, but everything else going about, just opening up, letting people know that it's okay, and, you know, it's okay to not be okay, that we can make a change and really see a difference in not only my life, but hopefully a lot of other people's.
So from your experience, have you received a positive reaction from guys about this project and like a willingness to
Absolutely.
Get behind it?
Nothing but positivity, man. It's been not only just, you know, our friends, but also our mothers, people affected by it, of course, because you can't almost meet someone who hasn't had someone either in their family or their friend group who's been affected by this. So overwhelming positivity. I'm really happy with the feedback we're getting. Really, all we want to be doing now is just giving back to that cohort and showing that we're here to support them and do our best for the cause.
So have you already had like a burst of interest of people signing up and wanting to be part of this thing?
We have. I mean, a lot of our friends are already jumping onto it. I'm getting mates, you know, sending me messages. We've got about 15 runners in our database signed up so far. We've got 45 people that have been giving us money, which has been fantastic, you know, all going towards the charity Men's Mental Health Foundation. So, yeah, it's been good, but I mean, it's a long path ahead of us. We really want to be boosting those numbers and getting as much support from runners, donors and people as possible.
So do you think this is going to be like a long-term thing? Where are you hoping to take it?
Yeah, I mean, we've got in mind the Auckland Marathon as kind of a large kind of event that we're looking for. But I mean, if we can keep this going, you know, if we want to do other causes, then we will. You know, we're all students and we're all looking at this as a passion and a cause that we're all passionate about. So the more we can do for this and the more we just kind of keep it going, then absolutely, I think we're all on board with that.
You're hoping that this will create like a sea change, I guess, around mental health and particularly men's mental health?
I think so, man. Yeah. And like, honestly, you can already see something happening. Even in my daily life, through to like what's happening online, there's something is happening, and I think it'd be awesome to see, like, you know, within a few years from now, those statistics going down and a lot more happiness and just fulfillment in men's lives in New Zealand.
Is there anything else you'd want to add?
I guess the biggest thing is just start having a discussion. You know, everyone's involved by this, and it's not only men, absolutely women and everyone. You know, families are affected by this. So I think just start talking about it. If you'd like to, it would be great to get in contact with us. We've got a Facebook page, a website, and also an email if you'd like to get in touch. info@manaformen.com.nz. So,
and just remember that there's plenty of places you can go to if you want to talk to somebody. There's obviously Lifeline. You can reach them at 0800 543 354. Youthline 0800 376 633, or just, you know, talk to your friends and your family, and yeah, there's plenty of people who love you.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
On to something totally completely different. And now something completely different. This is, we're going to talk about, in the international segment, we're going to talk about the Zimbabwe election. So what I'm going to do in this piece is sort of, they're having an election. It's first election without Mugabe since 1980. We're going to go back through the circumstances of the country and a bit on the history of the country as to why this is such a BFD. Yeah, and we're gonna look at that, what might possibly
what
result.
What does BFD
out of this.
Mean? Does it mean big fucking deal?
Yes,
that's so cool. Learned so much.
Yeah, so we're gonna look back. We're not gonna look at the candidates because there's too many of them. But I am also gonna put a disclaimer in, just saying, like, again with the South Africa story, I am gonna talk in racialized terms: black, white, Indian, ascend, you know, etc. That's how the Zimbabwe government measure their population and the way they act and move about and track kind of racism like South Africa. So just be warned, those terms will be coming up. So yeah, let's get into it. The saga of Robert Mugabe's rule is finally set to close as Zimbabwe embarks on its first elections without him in just 6 days. As the country prepares to go to the polls, emboldened by the prospect of free and fair elections, both candidates are seeking to build the country up again so that it can re-emerge from the isolation and chaos that defined Mugabe's regime. Since Mugabe was elected to power in 1980, after the collapse of white minority-ruled Rhodesia, the country has endured illegal land grabs, economic collapse, ethnic violence, and has become a pariah state with relations to authoritarian regimes that for years propped up the Mugabe regime. But after the country teetered on the precipice of becoming another failed state in Africa, the political establishment finally made their move and ousted Mugabe. And now that the transitional period is almost over, a new hope for Zimbabwe potentially sits on the horizon. To remind us of what happened, here is the moment a Zimbabwean army official hijacked the state television station and detained the president in what they insisted was absolutely not a coup.
We wish to make it abundantly clear that this is not a military takeover of government. What the Zimbabwe Defense Forces is doing is to pacify a degenerating political, social, and economic situation in our country, which, if not addressed, may result in a violent conflict.
Zimbabwe is a country of both boundless hope and unfulfilled potential. The country has the highest literacy rate on the African continent. It has the foundations of a democratic system established under the Lancaster House Agreement. It has fertile land and enormous mineral reserves. And on top of this, it has direct freight rail links to both Atlantic and Indian Oceans. Most of all, however, it is home to Victoria Falls, arguably the second biggest tourist attraction in Africa before the pyramids. Yet for over 60 years, the political situation has meant that the country has not yet realized the economic and political freedoms that it has on many occasions been so close to achieving. It's a dream of Zimbabwe being a peaceful, democratic, multiracial society within the Commonwealth that stands as an African powerhouse to rival the likes of New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, and Canada. The dream has been obstructed by the political, economic, and racial divisions created by British colonialism that so often flare up into violence like an unhealed wound. So in order to understand the conditions around selection, I need to give a quick rundown of what the dream is and how it has so often been spoiled. And this process of obstructing that dream begins with a New Zealander called Sir Garfield Todd, who was Prime Minister of Southern Rhodesia. This is him.
I think our 56 years in Zimbabwe have been to us a time of tremendous fulfillment and blessing, and we are tremendously grateful that we were sent out from New Zealand in 1934 on a mission of which we had really no understanding, but it turned out to be the most wonderful privilege.
Amen, amen.
I thought I'd achieved a lot, but there was only one thing to achieve, and that was to lay a political foundation on which you could build a non-racial community sharing in government. And I failed to do that. So we had to have a civil war, lose 40,000 people in deaths, but that wasn't the biggest cost. The biggest cost was the damage you did to the people themselves, so many wounded, so many homes broken up, so many homes burnt down. It was devastating, and that could have been avoided.
Garfield Todd was in power from 1953 to 1958 and is one of New Zealand's unsung heroes. He was a politically liberal missionary from Invercargill, whose education system in Zimbabwe means that the population still remains one of the most educated on the continent. He mandated that black people be addressed by Mr. or Mrs. instead of AM or AF, which stands for African male or female, and he set in place the first step to black political agency, new multiracial trade unions. The plan was for Zimbabwe to be handed over to black majority rule in the 1960s under British supervision and to remain part of the Commonwealth. But he was ousted by Zimbabwe's white community as a dangerous, radical race traitor and was ostracized for fraternizing with non-whites. And instead of his dream of a multiracial society, the country illegally declared independence from Britain and continued white minority rule as a rogue state. Here is an example of the mainstream attitude towards desegregation that white Rhodesians had, as echoed by their Prime Minister, Mr. Ian Smith.
I don't believe in black majority rule ever in Rhodesia, not in a thousand years. I repeat, I believe in black and whites working together. If one day it's white and the next day it is black, I believe we will have failed, and I think it will be a disaster for Rhodesia.
Todd continued pushing his dream. He became a political prisoner in Rhodesia, but his dream for a multiracial state where all citizens were treated with dignity never died. And amid the death of Rhodesia and the free and fair democratic government created by the British during the Lancaster House negotiations, it seemed like Prime Minister Mugabe, Joshua Nkomo, and President Banana would realise Todd's dream. But it was not to be for a very simple reason. Unlike South Africa a decade and a half later, Zimbabwe never had a formal Truth and Reconciliation Commission for the crimes and atrocities of the Bush War and white minority rule. This set the foundation for the country today. Mugabe was a man filled with a desire for retribution against the West and anyone who stood against him. He set about dispossessing President Banana of his reserve powers and engaged in a tribal conflict against the minority Matabele using North Korean trained soldiers and former Bush War veterans. Here are testimonies from those related to some of the 35,000 who were shot, beaten, burned and butchered by the Gukurahundi in Zimbabwe's Matabeleland province.
What happened to your brothers?
They just killed them.
Do you know how they were killed?
They were killed by soldiers.
What were they doing at the time the soldiers arrived?
My one brother they killed when he was closing up his cattle.
And the other brother?
They found him asleep at night.
And shot him while he was asleep?
They woke him up and took him into the bush and shot him.
My family, he died. Was shot by the army. Met my grandfather and my kin's two sons.
So you lost your grandfather?
Yes.
And two uncles, cousins?
Yes.
What happened?
They just shot them.
Well, what exactly were the circumstances?
No, they just come. They only just shoot them when...
The army just walked into the village?
Yes, yes.
Did they, were they looking for particular people?
They were looking, they just only shoot only when they just saw them by the house. They shot them dead.
Did they question them before they shot them?
No.
They just walked into the village and shot them?
Yeah.
To further crush the dream of a multiracial, democratic, free society, the willing buyer, willing seller agreement over land agreed to between whites and blacks in Zimbabwe was in tatters when Mugabe took power. He demanded that Britain help fund resettlement of blacks onto white land. However, Britain declined to do so on the basis of its increasing authoritarianism. When Britain finally stopped meeting the cost of land redistribution, this happened.
With white farmers still owning the bulk of the land, veterans of the war and the unemployed grew impatient. A dispute with Britain over compensation for land redistribution saw farmers intimidated, beaten, or even murdered. Mugabe's government allowed it to happen, then facilitated it and encouraged it, ignoring court rulings that it was illegal.
I'm now going to have an enforcement from Harare to come and take more farms.
How can you surrender something willingly that you've lived on for 60 years? We shall have to sell all the mulatta, I suppose, to try and get our money back and this sort of thing, and gum poles and what have you. We'll try and sell all that before we go, and all our tobacco and maize and cattle. And we won't put in a wheat crop, and then we'll wish the comrades the very best of British luck.
Decades of agricultural experience departed, voluntarily or forcibly. The consequence was that a country which was once regarded as the breadbasket of Africa began to starve. Harvests shrank, shelves were empty, and rampant inflation meant currency became virtually worthless. Through it all, Mugabe, who took on the title of president, blamed others for the problems.
What we reject is the persistence of vestigial attitudes from the Rhodesian yesteryears. Attitudes of a master race, master colour, master owner, and master employer.
The Commonwealth suspended Zimbabwe's membership. Mugabe opted to quit the organisation. International sanctions were imposed. Mugabe remained defiant.
Whilst the veterans continued to do their damage and the economy nosedived, Mugabe started printing money and the currency experienced hyperinflation. The Zimbabwe dollar was abandoned, food shortages and power outages became common, and the political situation deteriorated further. Whites and Indians continued to flee, and when opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai looked set to replace Mugabe in 2008 as president, he was forced to shelter in the Dutch embassy in Harare, fearing for his life. And so we come to this election. Mugabe is gone, but there are still concerns. Emmerson Mnangagwa, the transitional president, is still part of the ZANU-PF political machine that has dominated national politics since 1980. He played a role in the Gukurahundi killings. He aided Mugabe in silencing and intimidating political dissidents. And many in the country fear that his election will give him a mandate to continue Mugabe's ruination of the country. But he has held public meetings with the white farmers of the country. He has promised against further land grabs and instead has proposed leases that will initiate a smooth transition towards the black majority gaining their economic freedom too through industrial agriculture. His rhetoric seems to be conciliatory rather than confrontational, and there's hope that the election ZANU-PF oversees will finally be free and fair. Most importantly, his background looks like it will favour the economy. He is from rural Masvingo province and understands the importance of agriculture. He has emboldened Zimbabweans to return to vote. He has emboldened some to consider moving back. But with so many what-ifs surrounding his potential presidency, it's unclear if anything significant will change. If he lives up to the talk, Zimbabwe will become an open, democratic society that engages economically with the rest of the world, and finally sees swathes of the black majority population starting businesses and gaining employment. It's an image that resembles the dream Garfield Todd had for a radical new liberal society in southern Africa. July the 30th will be the day we will see if it comes to fruition. All that is clear is that in 6 days, the Mugabe era of Zimbabwean history will be well and truly over. The question is, will Mnangagwa continue the policies? That is the big question at the moment. If you are Zimbabwean, do text in 5395 or call in at 309-387-9. The other thing I was going to say on top of that, everyone knows Mnangagwa is going to win. Nelson Chamisa, he doesn't really have the charisma that Morgan Tsvangirai had. Morgan Tsvangirai obviously has unfortunately passed away. Yeah, absolutely, rest in peace. Do get in touch and let us know if you are Zimbabwean. Would you go back? Would you go back to vote? Would you even go back to live? And if you
Mnangagwa was in charge.
And as my old mate Stevie Wonder said, peace has come to Zimbabwe.
Absolutely, yeah. And equally, if you are a New Zealander and from anywhere else and you look at the situation there, would you still go on holiday there if you could? Would Victoria Falls be enough to wade through the political, crap storm, shit storm that is going on there?
Cool. So, yeah. Thanks, Connor.
All right.
Thank you, Connor.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Ko te wire, tēnei maronga BFM. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. The time is 27 minutes to past 12. We'll be right back after Three Ralphs by DJ Shadow.
Thank you.
Want to help save people's lives but can't be bothered getting your hands dirty? Good news! The New Zealand Blood Service is setting up a blood drive, and all you need to do is join them for a pint. Your shout, of course. From Monday to Friday this week, head to the Student Union Building. That's building B311 to give blood and do your part for the betterment of humanity. Book with the app, nzblood.co.nz, or call 0800-GIVE-BLOOD, 0800-448-325 to book an appointment today.
A group of emperor penguins huddled close, moving together in synchronized waves. This is Universal Harmony.
Radiating togetherness with positive energy. This is Universal Harmony.
As wholesome as fresh sliced sourdough and as empowering as winning a prize at school assembly. This is Universal Harmony.
Tuesday nights from 10 till midnight are reserved for Universal Harmony with Dr. Snickers, only on 95 BFM.
Putting the bubble back in your moe. That's Universal Harmony.
What are you even worried about? It's Worry Week on The Wire.
It is indeed another Wire Worry Week, and we're looking this week into substance use, abuse and legislation around it. Adam Winstock founded the Global Drug Survey in 2011. Pearl asked him about the effectiveness of a new trend, pill testing, at music festivals.
What's the first thought that pops into your head when you think of a music festival? Is it culturally appropriate outfits, port-a-loos, people with hula hoops, binge drinking? Or what about drugs? Music festivals are a thing, and so is taking mind-altering substances. Going to a music festival and taking mind-altering substances at the same time, definitely a thing.
And there's like loads of drum and bass, loads of lights, and then everything was just like, whoa.
Often people worry about what could be hidden in the drugs they take and how what's in them could cause adverse effects. If you read any news coming out of music festivals, especially overseas, it feels like a lot of people are dying from drug-related deaths. The common narrative surrounding deaths from drugs at festivals is that people die because they take what they think is one thing, but really it's something completely different. What happens here is that people aren't certain about what they're taking and therefore treat one substance the way they treat another, potentially causing dangerous and negative effects. So, in saying this, it seems like the obvious solution is to test the drugs to check they're legit, which a lot of festivals are starting to do across Europe and even here in New Zealand. But is it really this simple? Apparently not. Navigating the minefield of drug-related death and harm reduction is far more complicated than it seems, and a simple pill testing kit might not be the solution, as Adam is about to explain to me.
Okay, I mean, so I guess I probably need to be upfront. So particularly in a country like New Zealand, where, yeah, it's got a role.
Mm.
But it's not the be-all and end-all, and the validity, you know, there's huge differences between the different technologies that are used and their ability to actually accurately identify what's in drugs. So some are better for pills, some better for powders, you know, some won't spot mixed pills.
Adam is